on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
There is definitely this connection to religious experience and even like mysticism. And I think you even note that often these, and we've talked about a little bit, but that often these experiences are akin to a mystical experience.
They are often fundamentally akin to mystical experience, particularly in the awe that they can impart and the kind of you don't necessarily get those moments of all knowing or kind of full knowledge of the universe, a kind of a download that you do often get with certain mystical experiences, but you do get that probably the most important aspect, which is the after effects, the change in the individual. Now, I won't say that this is as pronounced as in, for instance, the near-death literature, but it is importantly, not ubiquitous, but is importantly present. It is there. And in that regard, I would say that it's definitely similar to a mystical experience. And again, to reiterate, it really does have the capacity to not just change an individual's sense. Like when you really think about like going from not believing in an afterlife to believing in one within 60 seconds, I mean, that is deeply fascinating when you think about it. Like that is a shift that would be almost impossible to kind of bring about in any other way.
Yeah.
And it's for those kinds of reasons that these experiences are important, whatever their full and their true nature and meaning. We're talking about on a dime, somebody changes their entire conceptualization of the cosmos, their place in it.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Daniel Bork to discuss his book, Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. Daniel shares his fascination with crisis apparitions, the cross-cultural references and historical occurrences of this phenomena. We explore the implications of crisis apparitions, their relation to the belief in an afterlife, religious and mystical experiences, and the intersection of science and anecdotal accounts. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Daniel Bork is an author, researcher, poet, and singer-songwriter. He has a background in the natural sciences, the arts, and the video game industry. He has previously published in the Dark Lore Journal. He joins me today to discuss his book, Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. Daniel, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you very much for the invite, Nick, and I'm happy to be here.
Of course, of course. I'm looking forward to speaking with you about this. I have a personal interest in,
really,
yes, these apparitions at the moment of death.
Interesting.
I had an experience with that. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but I wanted to ask you first, what was your interest in this?
Yeah, well, it's a number of things. Like in general, I've just always kind of been interested in, you know, the kind of most fundamental mysteries of existence and things and just why are we here, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of obvious philosophical things. But regarding the crisis apparition specifically, I will say that a lot of people ask me, did a specific experience, was it something that set it off for you? But no, there were multiple experiences in my family, but it wasn't actually until I finished writing the book that really came back to mind, which is interesting. The impetus for the book specifically, though, was that over probably the last 10 years, I became kind of familiar with the research relating to these experiences, but I couldn't find this book. I couldn't find the book that showed that this is a cross-cultural, ancient and historical and ongoing phenomenon. So I wanted to contextualize the work of the parapsychologists in relation to the ethnologists, the anthropologists, the historians, even the biographers of the saints, etc., etc., because I was convinced that due to the extent to which this experience has been found in numbers in, say, France or England or North America in the late 20th century, and even the late 19th century, I was convinced that if I looked for them, they would be there. And thankfully they were, because otherwise I wouldn't have had content for the book.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of what started it off.
Okay. So you've never actually had one of these experiences yourself?
Me personally, no.
Okay.
But in my family, there has been a number of experiences that are essentially exactly akin to a kind of a typical quote unquote crisis apparition. So,
Okay. What would be the typical crisis apparition?
the book is called Apparitions at the Moment of Death, but that's a more generally there are broader intimations of a distant death. So, in other words, for whatever reason, for whatever quirk of the universe, whatever natural kind of phenomenon, people become aware of the distant death of a loved one, not always a loved one, but most often a loved one, in and around the time that it occurs, often at the exact time that it occurs. So this can come by way of an apparitional experience where you'll see the form of the individual. And in many cases, this will be the first time in the individual's life that they've ever seen any apparition, let alone one that coincides with a distant death, which is kind of the fundamental mystery of it in the first place. But there can also be auditory intimations, intuitive intimations, intimations related to feelings in the body that actually relate to the nature of the distant death or accident, because this is part of a broader psi, quote unquote, psi phenomenon wherein kind of distant information is attained. This just happens to relate to a death. But put simply, the individual becomes aware of a distant death, and they are it's very quickly confirmed that the death that the information was accurate, that the death actually did occur at that time. Now, often there are more details around this, such as the clothing the apparition wears may actually be the clothing that was worn at the time. The wound may be in the spot that the wound really was, for example. There are many different details, but the fundamental nature and mystery of the Christ apparition is that it's the coincidence of the appearance with the distant death.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, the experience I had was, and you do cover this in the book, but my experience was in a dream.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm happy to hear it.
I was mostly raised by my maternal grandparents, and when I was 16, my grandfather stayed home from work one day, and that was notable because my grandfather never stayed home from work. He thought he had the flu or something like that. And then in the middle of the night, I was awakened by my grandmother that my grandfather had collapsed and ambulance was on the way. And so it was in the Midwest and it was January and it was sleeting, you know, the freezing rain. And the last thing my grandfather ever says, 'cause I don't want you driving. So I stayed at home
Okay.
and I kind of stayed up for a little bit. I got the message that they were flying my grandfather to another city for an operation. And I wasn't entirely sure what was going on. So eventually I sort of went back to bed. And then I had this dream. And as far as I can tell, the timing of me going back to sleep in the dream were at the time that my grandfather died. And
Okay.
in the dream, I was standing in my backyard. And when I was a little kid, that's what I would do. I would stand in this one spot waiting for my grandfather to come home
Wow.
from work. And he had this old red Ford pickup truck. And in the dream, I'm standing in that spot and I see my grandfather coming up, walking up to his truck. And he just stops. He looks at me and waves and
Wow.
then gets in the truck and drives off.
Wow, okay.
And I've often said that no one can tell me that wasn't my grandfather saying goodbye.
That is a very, very powerful experience.
Yeah.
Appreciate you sharing that. It's interesting because, so obviously, then you would have had the confirmation later then that unfortunately he had passed.
Right.
And like, this is actually something that I don't go into in too much detail in the book, but it is something I'm working on at the moment in another book. Is that so? Okay. So obviously, we can easily say we could easily ascribe it to coincidence and be done with it. Okay.
Right.
I don't think that necessarily is helpful. Obviously, in the sense that fundamentally, even if it was a coincidence, it doesn't mean there isn't much to be learned from it.
Right.
But here's the interesting thing, okay? So it's interesting enough that you have a dream of your grandfather in and around or exactly at the moment that he passed. But what's most interesting about the experience that you shared is that it's not just that he's appearing, he's actually behaving in a contextually relevant manner. So he's actually. This has kind of been overlooked, even though it seems obvious when you say it. He was waving goodbye to you. So, in other words, how many dreams before and after that have you? Let's specify before that have you had, where, for instance, your grandfather is waving goodbye to you. Probably not many. It's a very specific type of action which denotes something very particular, which is I'm leaving, I'm going away. Not necessarily forever, but I'm certainly leaving. And I think that the fact that the apparition often, and in the dream, we may or may not be able to call it an apparition, but the form will say, is actually behaving in a manner relevant to its situation in real life at the same time as its coincidental appearance. So that adds a kind of a powerfully extra corroborative element to it. And so I thought that was very interesting that you share that experience and that aspect of it turned up, because it's quite common. And that, along with some other kind of more idiosyncratic things than a wave. Like, for instance, if you had an after-death communication, a kind of a more general apparition of experience after somebody's death, you could make the argument, obviously, that if they were waving to you, it would make sense. You know, in some sense, your mind may or may not be involved. It makes sense to have the apparition waving, either to say hello again or goodbye. Who knows? Maybe you have some unfinished business, etc. But it becomes a little more strange when it's at a time when you didn't know that the individual was in a contextually relevant situation. So while the fundamental mystery of the crisis apparition is the timing, it's the coincidence itself, those layers keep piling up and it does become a little bit deeper, a little bit stranger. And those particular aspects haven't actually been addressed that much in general. And that's something that I do hope to address in a future work.
It one of the things that jumped out at me in the book was some of the symbolism, and I think this is along the lines of what you were just saying, that one of the common symbols in these apparitions, visions, dreams is that of a journey, that the person who is leaving is going on a journey. And
Yes.
that's how I felt with my grandfather, that he was getting in his truck and he was going somewhere else.
Really, that's so interesting. Did he actually get in the truck or just kind of move towards it and had the sense?
He got in the truck and he drove away.
Wow. Wow, I apologize. I didn't actually catch that bit of the first time you said it. That's fascinating. So yeah, in the book I was making the point in the chapter that deals with allegorical and symbolic visions and dreams that in general the other world has kind of historically been referenced as a place of allegory, a place of symbolism. You know, some of the most ancient stories dealing with other world journeys, kind of encounters in that other world, kind of take this guise in many cases. But just bring it down to a more kind of simple level, like at the deathbed, like much of the language that's used by the dying becomes more and more symbolic the closer they get to death, often symbolic of the journey. In specific ways, like they may say, for instance, you know, I'm going to be taking the train on a certain day, or I'm has any have ever has everyone got their kind of suitcases packed, etc., etc. There is this sense of a reference to a longer journey. But it's to speak again to the crisis apparition, what's interesting is that this language also turns up in those crisis apparitions when the death wasn't known about. So it's very interesting. It ties the two experiences together, the deathbed vision, for instance, and the crisis apparition in an interesting way. And so to summarize, like the language of the journey is common, but that speaks to the fact that symbolism in general, I won't necessarily say it's common, but it does turn up a lot, and especially in the dreams, and often in highly like culturally specific ways. Like, for instance, in the book, I reference accounts where the apparition will appear wearing very particular clothing, for instance, and a type of clothing that is specifically referencing death in that culture. Or the if I refer, in one account, if I remember correctly, the bride isn't supposed to turn her head back while she's walking down the aisle, and somebody had a dream where they did, and it's generally considered that if they do, they will die early, for instance. But it turned out that person had actually died at that exact time, so the death is often represented in a highly symbolic and culturally specific manner, and that comes through in the visions, the dreams, and the apparitions.
And is there also, I apologize if I'm missing this, but are there also sort of precognitive death visions where someone has this vision of someone who's going to die?
Well, that's a very interesting question in relation to this book, because I don't. So, if we look at the original definition of crisis apparition in the late 19th century, it was kind of arbitrarily related to a period of not only 12 hours after the death, but also 12 hours before the death. So in some sense, there is a precognitive element to these visions which occur 12 hours before the death. Like, and obviously, there obviously is the conversation then, is something precognitive or is it telepathic? For instance, you can easily mistake something that is quote unquote telepathic with something that's precognitive. In other words, many of these visions, they may occur in and around the time of death. In other words, before also. So you could have a vision of the individual dying, for example, but not actually dead. And you could maybe interpret that as precognitive because they did then die. But then you could also say, well, the intimation came from the individual at the moment itself. So there is a gray area there. But to speak generally, according to the actual original definition, you would be correct in suggesting there are precognitive elements involved.
Okay, good. And I found it fascinating that you looked at instances throughout history. I mean, you looked at myth and literature, poetry, and whatnot. I've got a couple questions in regards to that. The first one I will ask you, though, is what is one of the earliest recordings of a death apparition?
Well, in the book, the very earliest one I could find that was in a recognizable form, in other words, it's essentially indistinguishable from those that would follow, would be from ancient Egypt, would be
Okay.
from the pharaoh Senosroet. And I believe it's the first, it's the second or third account that I actually present in the book. And I believe it was 1936 BC, and it was recorded in a poem from a father to his son. It's a pretty well-renowned poem. Now, I will say this and I make this clear in the book that this particular account has never been picked up on as a Christ apparition, which is the case with many of the accounts in the book, again, which is why I wanted to write the book. But the account is often referenced as potentially some sort of political device, just a general artistic type of piece, etc. But puts but at the in the piece itself, the very simple narrative is that the father is killed in a raid on his castle, and at the same time he appears to his son as a ghost. And not only reveals the fact that he had died, but the manner of his death, something that apparitions still do. And that death, of course, is then later confirmed. Now, that would be the earliest recognizable one that I could find, but there are numerous then that turn up a few thousand years later among the Greeks, for example, in the plays, in the tragedies, in the. Like even in relation to the Trojan War, etc., there are crisis apparitions, and I will say that certain scholars, such as Debbie Felton, who wrote "Ghosts of Ancient Greece and Rome," or sorry, "Haunted Greece and Rome," she pinpointed a number of these as specifically as crisis apparitions, in relation to parapsychology. So it's always interesting to see kind of more mainstream scholars reference parapsychology at all,
Yeah.
let alone kind of agree with them. So that's always an
Right.
interesting one. So there are numerous old ones, but that would be the most ancient that I was able to find.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's a, on one level, it's sort of a motif that's used often. And it seems like it can be used for different purposes. Like you said, there was the possibility that the one you just described, it was a political device. And one that kind of jumped out at me, you go through a lot of some of the lives of the saints, and that happens frequently. And this is in the section where you were talking about collective accounts, where more than one person has this experience. And the one that, like I said, kind of jumped out at me, and I'm probably going to pronounce part of this incorrectly, and this is directly from the book, but there was the French Christian martyr, Valerie of Limoges, I'm not sure how to pronounce that when she died, a crowd nearby saw a dazzling light and Valerie herself flying away in it. According to the legend, those present were so affected that they all converted to Christianity that very day. And it seemed to me, I was like, well, that's a nice little brochure there to
Absolutely.
talk about your religion to get people to sort of accept it and convert to it.
Absolutely. I think I love that you focus in on that. That's interesting because it is the case, and I do try to make it clear in the book that, in fact, in the book, I actually give examples. I give examples of ones that are known to be, for instance, not actually historical events.
Okay.
And therefore, we cannot we can infer from that that without any doubt that they were used for those types of reasons. I just want to make the point that, like, and I think you are a testament to this, considering that you shared your own experience. There's a few things here. A, we can look at what we can look at that perspective and say that therefore this isn't a real phenomenon, we're going to discount it.
Right.
Or we can say that what is obviously much more likely in light of just how ubiquitous this phenomenon really is. When we understand that, and to be clear, that's not something that I would imagine that many hagiographers are actually aware of
Right.
at all. And like, I can't imagine they necessarily peruse the parapsychological literature of the 20th century, but it would make it, to me, it seems a lot more reasonable that the extent to which these accounts appear in the lives of the saints would speak to the extent to which, A, the hagiographer understood that there were events that would be convincing to the public. B, they would be things that they would probably be familiar with. And just to even be more specific, I wouldn't, by no means does that mean that all of the accounts of the lives of saints didn't occur. I would imagine many actually did occur. In some cases, such as this case of the English Saint Cuthbert, his entire conversion, sorry, his choice to take the kind of monastic path is predicated upon a crisis apparition in the first place. Now, it's the book isn't the important point in the book is not necessarily whether or not that happened, although that is an interesting and important conversation. It's why is it recorded? Why is it in the record? And why is it indistinguishable from accounts that still occur today? And is there a relationship between those two facts? And what is it? And can we parse it? And to be honest, like, part of my goal in writing this book and in putting it all out there in one place was because I can't answer all these questions myself, and I would
Right.
love for other people to kind of dive in and get a little bit more specific, maybe. And I actually write in the I write on this in the epilogue a little bit that there's much work to be done in
Oh,
this kind
yeah.
of more specific parsing of what accounts actually happened, why were they implemented, etc., etc. But it's an interesting point, and I think that it could go in many directions off it.
Yeah, for sure. And I find it interesting. I mean, you noted, and I've never heard this term before, paraanthropology, in terms of you cite some of the very early anthropologists that were recording these sorts of crisis apparitions of the people that they were kind of, examining or researching were having. And there is a movement in some, not all, but some disciplines that starting to look at these things, like in religious studies, which is my background. I know that there are a couple of scholars that are saying, hey, we really ought to look at this stuff because this fits in with so much of what we actually examine and study. And to the point of, like the lives of the saints.
Yeah, absolutely. Within the lives of saints, yes, that is definitely kind of occurring more and more. Not to cut you off now, but it is the case. Like, you're right. Like, specifically among kind of people who research hagiographies, there is a kind of an increasing, no, it's not like this overwhelming movement or anything, but there is this increasing sense that there are different angles from which we should be looking at these texts, etc., etc., and there are potentially things we could learn from them. And they're not, everything isn't necessarily contrived. Like, obviously certain things are going to be contrived. I mean, we could look at the levitations, the physical levitations of John of Cupertino, for
Right.
instance, or Mary of Assisi, I believe, or Mary Agreda, I don't know how to pronounce it, but her levitations, etc., too, in the early modern period. We can obviously cast a skeptical eye on certain things. That's okay, but it's important not to go wholesale in that regard, especially when we have phenomena that are entirely indistinguishable from those that still occur today. And I think that any kind of generalized movement in that direction is helpful. But of course, like anything, let's just, not go too far in one direction or the other. Let's just try and have a balanced conversation about it. And I think that's only going to be beneficial.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to examine, and because it is so prevalent around the world and through history, it seems it's something that seems to be part of the human story in many ways.
Absolutely. It seems to be that the crisis apparition is a, well, if we take it, well, for if we take it at face value, it is a fundamentally universal and human experience. Whatever its kind of fundamentally kind of in epistemic nature, like for instance. So it is nevertheless something that occurs widely, and it still is ongoing. Like the fact that you like I was interviewed by Jason Louv of Ultra Culture, and he had the same experience with a he had a story to tell me as well. And so you're the so far I've had maybe 4 or 5 interviews, so we're heading up, we're close to 50% of interviewers in that regard. So it is something that you will find that people you know have experienced but don't necessarily speak about. There isn't necessarily the kind of welcoming environment, or kind of, I don't know, we don't necessarily have the kind of like cultural cosmology to assimilate these experiences easily. But they occur, and they are spoken about in smaller circles. And because, like, one of the things that are often leveled at people who have these experiences, or rather, kind of quote unquote supernatural experiences in general, is that they're kind of looking for attention, or they want to feel special. And let's be clear, those people exist within and without those groups. But by no means is that exclusive to those groups. And the fact is that in I would argue that the majority of the people who have these experiences do not share them, and that therefore their incidence is almost always actually underestimated. And these are not stories that people readily share for fear, obviously, of being ridiculed, et cetera, but not just that, they're highly personal, often extremely moving. We're talking about like experiences that sometimes last 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, but the effects can truly change the individual in a fundamental way for a lifetime. And this is borne out in the book. There's a section in the second, in the coming up towards the end of the first chapter, where I deal with this and give multiple examples of not only the fact that people still have these experiences and undergo those exact effects, but the same experiences and effects were recorded, for instance, in ancient Rome. So you'll like these experiences. Like, for instance, the famous poet Wilfred Owen, he had a crisis apparition experience on a boat, where he had the appearance, his brother appeared to him and waved goodbye, and he later found that it occurred at the exact moment that he had died. He made the point that that actually was one of the things that specifically cured his depression, which is a very fascinating insight. But you have other examples as well of individuals saying, this was the experience that actually convinced me that there is something beyond this life, there is an afterlife. And I think that when you see these pile up, it becomes interesting to consider the historical place of the crisis apparition as a potentially as potentially in relation to the root of religious beliefs, certain religious beliefs, or certain beliefs relating to an afterlife, etc. Kind of the obvious things like near-death experiences are often brought up in this regard, dreams. But I think the crisis apparition has been overlooked in this regard. And when we look at the testimony, it is the case that people do fundamentally change their sense of their place in the cosmos at the whim of these experiences. Is that always the case? No, but it seems to be more often than not. And at the very least, we know that the experience has the capacity to do that. And for that reason, it deserves attention in and of itself, irregardless of its reality, I would argue.
I one of the things that I had noted down was that you were kind of pondering whether these experiences could in fact be the root of the belief in an afterlife.
I wasn't pondering if it was not to, I'm sure you, not to say you suggested the, not to say you formulated the question wrong, but I wasn't saying it was the root, but one of the potential avenues by which one would get there. Because, like, for instance, it could be the instance, it could actually instantiate belief in the afterlife. We know that from the accounts. But of course, it could also, you know, bolster beliefs that are already there, which were potentially based on other experiences, et cetera. And who knows, maybe that has played a part in why it's been forgotten, because maybe it actually plays that secondary role more often than not, as opposed to the primary role. Who knows? But without any doubt, it is this experience, somebody said, as I wrote in the book, which assured me that there was a life after this one. There is no doubt that people still have these experiences and still are still convinced of the reality that, I mean, it makes sense that the individual would be kind of impacted in this way when you think about it, because the extent to which the crisis apparition is a kind of a novel, deeply mysterious and fundamentally strange thing, And I say that at least in relation to our current knowledge, because obviously, generally speaking, if it's part of the universal grand scheme of things, it's normal.
Right.
But the extent to which it's truly mysterious in that regard has a little bit been lost in the mix, I think, even among like parapsychologists, et cetera, it becomes rote, you know, it's one after the other. But for the individual, this is something that is truly fundamentally strange. And even for somebody like me and the readers, et cetera, similar, I think that I hope that a similar kind of sense of that strangeness can be imparted upon reading the number of the counts and the ubiquity and the kind of breadth and depth of them historically and cross-culturally, et cetera, et cetera. So it is something that is a genuine social phenomenon, but not particularly well known, written about. I just hope that there is more written about it in the future.
Well, and it's curious, why do some people have these experiences and others do not? Why do, spirits appear to some people? And one of the things that I always found really interesting in the examples that you gave were when the dearly departed appeared to a stranger or a neighbor or something like that, rather than a family member.
Isn't that a fascinating thing? It's a strange thing, and it does speak to your original question, because the original question regarding who sees them and why, because obviously if we came to the conclusion that certain people can experience spirits and others can't, then it would make sense that there would be some cases where an individual who can't would have to be told by a third party. That would follow. So it is consistent in that regard. But like in general, the fact that there is a certain type of individual who can see what others don't, that's actually a chapter in the book, Those Who See, Those Who Don't, and it deals with this idea, and it's incredibly widespread. It's oftentimes there is a kind of a special culturally important person singled out, whether it's the shaman, whether it's the saint, the medicine man, the witch, etc. But what comes through here is that it actually may it what comes through here is that it can often be that the individual has these experiences that impels them to those positions in the first place. So for whatever reason, whether this phenomenon is something representative of something solely psychological or something with an external element, it would probably make sense that if it's a capacity, if it's a skill, or it would kind of be distributed among the population in the way that any capacity or skill is. Some can, some can't, some are better, some are worse, et cetera. But to then bring it back to your point about a third party, it is interesting because there are researchers such as like Hilary Evans, for instance, who wrote Seeing Ghosts, an incredible and underrated work, I would say, in the parapsychological kind of literature. He cites accounts such as those that you just mentioned as especially powerful evidence for the externality of the ghost as a phenomenon in general, because he argues that like the extent to which one has to go to fit that type of encounter into a purely telepathic kind of mind-to-mind exchange between people living, it's not impossible, but it kind of stretches the kind of it stretches those theories to their limits. Now, that's just a kind of an interesting side point. But yeah, for whatever reason, there are those who see, those who don't. I don't claim to know why in the book, but it absolutely is the case. And it is fascinating. And who knows, maybe life would be m much more boring if everyone could see. Who knows? Maybe it's more fun that there are mysterious others who see things we don't. And it's meant to be that way. Who knows?
Well, it would be very unfair to put the burden on you to explain why is this happening and things like that.
I appreciate that.
For sure. One of the things that was interesting is I think that often people, when they hear about, the crisis apparitions, they just think of, that sort of ghostly figure that shows up in the middle of the night, and someone sees it. But there are different kinds of sort of, I don't know if they would all fall under the category of crisis apparitions. So, for example, there are noises, for example, that you write about, the knockings, pots and pans clanging about. And it would seem that in something like that, more than one person might have that experience that, if there's several people in a house and the pots and pans are clanging about, or pictures are falling off the wall at the time of death, that it would be more than one person that would have that experience.
Yes, I mean, are you saying that you would expect that, or are you saying that because that's the case, it would speak to its externality? Or are you just kind of observing it generally?
That,
Interesting.
if something like that is happening, it's not just one person who would experience that.
Yeah, true. And it is common. It is common, especially in the folklore. And you said you live in the Midwest. There's a lot of Midwest folklore that speaks to these types of experiences. And oftentimes there are multiple witnesses to these experiences. And this is something that is still, again, still occurring. And regarding the noises, et cetera, something that's interesting about auditory work is that, to my knowledge, like auditory hallucinations are generally not related to death in general. So it's kind of an interesting thing just to see how many are related to death in these accounts. But in terms of the kind of collective nature of these auditory experiences, there are multiple accounts of the book that speak to this. These turn up in the Lives of the Saints too. It could be the ringing of a bell of a famous church that's heard. Like, I see a lot of these things. For instance, did that bell really ring? Maybe. Did they all hear a bell? Also, maybe. But like, it could be the case that, like, I think these more kind of simple kind of domestic experiences that are still common with frames falling, pictures smashing, etc. I think those things may, for all we know, those things are kind of dramatized in the stories, dramatized in the Lives of the Saints. The general concept of a sound referencing a death is brought to bear in a more dramatic manner. I don't think something as simple as a frame falling would necessarily be ideal for a dramatic hagiography. Who knows? But yeah, I think these accounts do have the capacity to speak to the potential externality of this phenomenon due to the potentially collective nature of them. I don't speak to that too much in the book, but I do make the point that, like, what's important about the collective accounts is that they go a long way to convincing those involved, that's for sure. I mean, and you can obviously see why. You have somebody else who experienced what you did, and sometimes there are differences. One, like, something that parapsychologists were very concerned with in the late 19th century, but sorry, the late 20th century, but also the mid 20th century, is these collective accounts and the extent to which sometimes, for instance, the apparition may appear slightly differently to two different people. Okay. And then that may be seized upon as proof that it is a fundamentally mind-based phenomenon or not necessarily have an external component. Obviously, I would argue it's not obvious, but I would argue that that's kind of jumping the gun and also skipping over the most important element of the experience, which is that something was perceived by two people, not only at the same time, but in coincidence with an actual distant event. So I think that all those details are less important than that fundamental, mysterious kind of aspect of the phenomenon itself. And it's easy to get lost in the weeds on that. But I think that, yeah, the fundamental occurrence of the experience as being in relation to a distant event and among multiple people, that is often what convinces the individual of their reality as well.
Well, and it also seems that, these experiences, even if it was not necessarily a person who was dying or had died communicating, but even if it was some kind of psychic event, that still is something that's really important to look at, that there is a
Absolutely.
psychic event that's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the point, is that whatever these experiences are, they are, and therefore they deserve attention. They haven't received much. They're often discounted because of their relation to a field that is kind of obviously tied, like, let's be honest, let's be clear, they are often tied to fields such as like UFOs or Bigfoot, etc. These things are often put together and lumped together, but that's just a kind of a individual issue that I'm with people in a particular type of culture that I can't really speak to, but it is the case. It is the case.
Well, and like I said, there are people who are starting to examine things like this. So, you mentioned like the UFOs. I'm currently teaching a class, and It's Religion and the Human Quest, and I got to choose the books. And one of the book that I'm ending the course on, is Diana Pasulka's American Cosmic. And what she was doing is she was exploring accounts of purgatory, and she noticed that in all of these old accounts, quite often people were talking about these like glowing orbs and flying about in the skies, and they interpreted it at that time as souls. But yet now we interpret it as UFOs. And so is looking at this kind of phenomena through the lens of religious studies. And I think that, that's something that we can look at in these accounts as well, because there's definitely this connection to religious experience and even like mysticism. And I think you even note that often these, and we've talked about a little bit, but that often these experiences are akin to a mystical experience.
They are often fundamentally akin to mystical experience, particularly in the awe that they can impart, and the kind of you don't necessarily get those moments of all knowing or kind of full knowledge of the universe, a kind of a download that you do often get with certain mystical experiences. But you do get that, the most probably the most important aspect, which is the after effects, the change in the individual. Now, I won't say that this is as pronounced as in, for instance, the near-death literature, but it is importantly, not ubiquitous, but is importantly present. It is there, and in that regard, I would say that it's definitely similar to a mystical experience. And again, to reiterate, it really does have the capacity to not just change an individual's sense. Like when you really think about like going from not believing in an afterlife to believing in one within 60 seconds, I mean, that is deeply fascinating when you think about it. Like that is a shift that is. That is a shift that would be almost impossible to kind of bring about in any other way. And it's for those kinds of reasons that these experiences are important, whatever their full and their true nature and meaning. We're talking about on a dime, somebody changes their entire conceptualization of the cosmos, their place in it, and then maybe other things too. Because if you're suddenly thinking that, okay, this, I mean, you could extrapolate so much just from that moment. You could extrapolate from that moment that, okay, well, if that's the case, then maybe things are kind of set up in a way. Maybe there's a kind of a design behind things, a meaning. Maybe there's a so like something must regulate that experience. If that external apparition is in some way a real thing, it's obviously regulated. Maybe it was sent here, and then you have to ask from where? Who knows? Who asked it to go? Et cetera, et cetera. But then you could even say, is there? You may feel a kind of a more benign feeling towards the universe in those cases too. You may, because a lot of obviously there's a lot of kind of nihilism today, but who knows? These experiences can kind of engender something of the opposite as well. That kind of sense of, wait a minute, maybe the universe is extending an olive branch here. Maybe it's letting me in on a little secret, and it's up to I can share it with others, and they will also reap some benefits too. But I can also keep it to myself, and maybe it's meant to be that way. Who knows? It's certainly up to the for the individual to decide. But yeah, I think that there's so much philosophically that one can draw from the actual 60 seconds to 2 minutes of the crisis apparition itself, and that could be a gift for many people.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. And it's, you mentioned the, nihilism, but also kind of hand in hand with that is a materialism
Very much
where it's
so.
all just matter. And I've had conversations along these lines where, people who take that approach, and if I mention this experience with my grandfather, they kind of wave it away.
They do,
And it
yeah.
seems like and you can try to reason and argue with people about the possibility of there being something more than matter, but it seems that the greatest thing that can happen is that subjective experience.
Really is. And the reality is that, like, we have to be open to the possibility that if there is a divine, if there is an other, if there is a realm beyond this realm, it may be the case that it's sure it's connected, but it may be separate to the extent that kind of general materialism or empiricism can't necessarily, quote unquote, prove its existence. Okay, we have to be open to the possibility that that line of communication to the individual, that may be the only true means of the communication. And the irony, of course, is that here and now in this material moment. Those are the accounts that are the least believed. Those are the sources that are the least believed. Anecdotes are not data,
Yeah,
they say.
right.
I disagree. I believe that we use anecdotes as data in many fields, and I think that also just the in general the use of the disparaging use of the word anecdote, it's
Right.
kind of intellectually dishonest because obviously different anecdotes have different levels of value and trustworthiness, et cetera, that's just off the bat. So I mean, just fundamentally to discount something because it's an anecdote inherently makes no sense. And then again, we also then can say, well, okay, maybe we can even give the admission that science can't deal with this. I'm not necessarily saying that, but I'm saying let's give it that. Okay, fair enough. Let's approach it. Let's let other fields approach it. Let's gather the information. Let's let the anthropologists, the psychologists, even the psychoanalysts, let the Freudians and the Jungians deal with it. You know, there's so much to get our hands around, our arms around here, that to say because it's not approachable with the scientific method, it's therefore of no value. I couldn't disagree more. I think that there's so much of value and so much truth that we live with in our day-to-day lives that we don't need to weigh or measure or anything of the sort. And again, I want to be clear, I'm not disparaging weighing and measuring. I'm just making the
Right.
point that we need to be balanced here and
Yeah.
we need to allow for the fact that the most important things to us may not be measurable and weighable, and that's okay. That's
Yeah.
okay.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And I agree with you. It always bothers me when someone waves away subjective experience. And the approach that I often take is, look, I can't make a truth claim one way or the other about what someone else experiences. But what I can do is say someone has had this experience and this is how they are interpreting it. And that doesn't mean that they're my interpretation may be better than theirs.
Absolutely. I mean, the ground floor of the dynamic should be okay, you had an experience and it was very valuable to you, and to the extent that like I'm seeing you change as an
Yeah.
individual. So like just as a kind of a ground floor courtesy, it would make sense not to be kind of belligerently dismissive, if you know
Right.
what I mean. It's not to say that the individual who's being belligerently dismissive isn't correct, but let's have an adult
Yeah.
conversation here, you know?
Yeah.
Let's realize the like I mean, is this imagine walking into a psychologist's office and having and expressing your thoughts and feelings about the world and having them discounted as subjective experiences. It wouldn't be very productive for anyone. I
Right.
think the same is true when it comes to the quote unquote paranormal, a term that I don't necessarily, you know, agree with as I think obviously everything is by definition normal and natural. I
Right.
think that and to be honest, to kind of work riff off of that is that like and speaking back to your point about this dynamic, you know, to ascribe some to name something supernatural, to call it magic. To do that is to allow yourself to dismiss it because obviously you already have a preconceived notion that such things can't fundamentally exist. So therefore, it can't exist. It's tautological. And people do
Yeah.
it all the time in conversation, and it's incredible to see. But the reality is, of course, that we cannot assume something to be. Here's the problem: is that a lot of the conversations that we're speaking about often happen between religious and non-religious people.
Yeah.
So the religious people actually do often hold the view that something is legitimately supernatural. It is actually outside of the natural laws. But then that's why it's hard. That's why when you converse with people from the materialist side and you're not necessarily religious, it can become challenging because they often think you're actually not being serious, that you're not
Yeah.
religious. They don't believe you.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, again, if something exists, it's by definition natural and it should exist and it's meant to be there. And we can't then call it something just to discount it. It's tautological and intellectually dishonest, and it doesn't forward debate in any way, shape, or form, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't like the dismissive attitude in some of these conversations. And it just seems a little, sometimes it comes across as a little bit arrogant that my
It
worldview
can.
is better than yours, and but
Absolutely.
yeah.
I mean, it absolutely can, and let's even be very fair and say that oftentimes, you know, both sides can be very arrogant. There's a
Oh,
lot of
yeah,
arrogance
for
coming
sure.
from both sides of the debate, but yeah, the it's not justified on either side, and the kind of casual, overconfident dismissal of these experiences as if we know their nature. I don't know what it speaks to, but it isn't necessarily something culturally productive. And maybe it speaks to a kind of a strangely overconfident sense that we have, that someone somewhere in our culture has discovered the kind of the truth of reality, the nature of things. We have it all figured out. Or 50 years ago, you might read in a magazine, we're almost there in physics, we're almost there in cosmology. We ain't almost there. So let's not pretend we know what the individual has experienced.
And that's what I was thinking a little bit ago while you were speaking, is that, a lot of folks like to think that we have all of the laws of nature figured out, and maybe we don't. Maybe
Maybe we
there's,
don't. Absolutely. And even if we quote unquote do, I mean, it doesn't speak to our knowledge of their entirety or their dynamics or the extent to which they may kind of confound our expectations in certain aspects. Like I often make the point that, okay, let's just pretend that the universe is deterministic for the sake of argument. Could it not be that it has been predetermined to come to a point where it is not deterministic anymore? They're not mutually exclusive at all. Just a small point to say that even though our current, to speak to your point, even though our understandings now, like as just to speak to your point that we may not know all of the laws, and then I was saying maybe we actually, even if we do, there may be dynamics on their path from where they began to where they're going that still will confound our expectations of what they're going to do. That was just a kind of a strange illustration of that with one of my own philosophical musings of potentially nonsense, but who knows?
One of this will be like one of my final questions, and it's probably something that we've been talking about, but I wanted to ask you. I had this in mind earlier, and it's the one of the few questions. Typically, when I interview folks, I just have like quotes from their book in front of me. I very rarely have questions, but I had a couple questions for you.
Okay.
And the one that I have here underlined was, well, what do these experiences tell us about the human condition?
That's a okay, I'm going to quit the interview now. No, I'm joking. That's
It's a big question,
a
and
big one.
it's I expect you to have all the answers.
Well, I absolutely do. Well, I would say that like fundamental, I'd say that the very least we can draw from these experiences is that s something that we don't know much about is occurring commonly among large amounts of people since the beginning of recorded history. That's what we can say. So it's and it is something that potentially has influenced the course of history in many more ways than we're aware. I don't want to overstate that. It could be a small amount, a very small amount, but who's to say whether or not small or big changes in history are important? We're talking about an at the individual level here. So, something that could be historically monumental for the individual might mean nothing to the group. It's a, and likewise, so I wouldn't kind of die on a hill in that regard, but I will say that like these are widespread, deeply fundamentally mysterious experiences that occur to people who often commonly have never experienced anything of this sort before, let alone that particular experience. They don't do again so afterwards. They're often very surprised that it has occurred. But what's interesting about the experiences themselves is that often, as they're occurring, they're described as kind of natural. The sense is, oh, this kind of feels like it was supposed to turn out this way, or this is kind of, oh, so this is how the universe works. I see. I didn't realize until this moment, etc. So it's interesting that something so novel, something so strange, can actually be experienced as its opposite, and that in and of itself may speak to the nature of things. Who knows? Maybe they're correct in their assumption that this is the way things are meant to be. It certainly seems to be the way things are meant to be. And the question then is just, is it external? Is it internal? The basic facts of the Christ's apparition suggest at least a partly external phenomenon. It is very challenging to explain it e more easily than that in any other way. But yeah, regarding the human condition itself, oh boy, I think it again. I think it just speaks to, it speaks to the human condition most simply in the sense that here is something else that we can add to the human condition. Here is something else we can say occurs to people, in all places at all times and widely. It's mysterious, it's strange, and it has amazing sometimes not amazing after effects, but certainly many times wonderful and encouraging after effects for the individual, helps them process grief and death. I mean, what greater gift could one ask for than that? You know, that is something truly special. And I think that, yeah, that's about it. That about sums it up,
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. No,
I'll
that's
try.
good. Yeah. And
I'll come up with something better next time.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, I apologize if it was an unfair question, but
Not at all, not
I
at all.
thought
I appreciate the question.
Well,
Not at
it just
all.
seems to me that it's just telling us, that the I'm going to paraphrase or steal a quote here, that the universe is a place both wonderful and strange.
Beautiful. I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamentally, that is what it tells you, because these are often both beautiful and strange experiences. So, and people exist in the universe. So, yeah,
Right.
the universe
Yeah.
is perhaps more beautiful and more strange than we ever realize. And these experiences can give you that sense, or at least show you that there is a path to coming to those conclusions. That's what's interesting for me.
Yeah. Well, I know that we are running out of time here, but I have a couple of final questions for you.
Fire away.
First one is, what are you working on next? You kind of mentioned another book, I seem to recall in our conversation.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'm working on. So I'm actually just about to send off the final manuscript for a book called Telepathic Tales. So that takes the concept of this book, which is to look at the crisis apparition as a cross-cultural and historical entity, but it expands it out into other psychical phenomena with a specific focus on ones that have been overlooked in the literature generally, such as the Norwegian Vardaga, for instance, which is the experience of seeing, hearing, visualizing somebody before they arrive, dreaming of them before they arrive. It's astonishingly widespread, and that's something that I was very excited to write about in this book. That book is going to be releasing July in 2025, something I'm very excited about. I'm also working on a book which deals with the phenomenon of deja reve through history, cross-culturally, and historically also. This is the idea of dreaming something, dreaming of somebody before one meets them, but not in the sense of deja vu. Deja vu is related to a vague sense that this has occurred before. In deja reve, the experience can be tied to a specific vision or dream, often that has been recorded before the event itself. And again, just like this book, what's very interesting about deja reve is the vast extent to which it's been utilized in the hagiographies. You'll find it in India, you'll find it in China, Japan, everywhere. These experiences are often they're often related to the individual finding their master, for instance, they're a doctor, somebody important, and they will visualize them before they meet them. I won't go on too much about that, but that's a book I'm working on that should probably will release next this time next year. And by
Okay.
this time next year, to be clear, I mean late 2025. But if I'm not wasting too much time here, I'll say that the book I did reference earlier, which you referenced just there, was actually a separate book, which is going to deal with the crisis apparition. I'm going to say the basic thesis of the book is, if the crisis apparition has been considered powerful evidence for the survival of consciousness, which it has actually been understated the extent to which it is that evidence. And I'm going to show in this book the extent to which that has been understated and the kind of idiosyncratic evidence that has not been addressed in the last in those 200 years that since they have been studied. That's something I've been wanting to write for a long time, actually, so I'm happy to be finally working on that.
Okay, wonderful. Well, hopefully we can speak again after some of these books come out.
Absolutely, we'd love to.
I'd love to continue the conversation as well, because I think it's important. I mean, human consciousness is how we experience the world, and again, I think it's much bigger than what most of us think.
Absolutely. The evidence seems to suggest that when it's looked at non-partially.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your time today and for all the work that you've done putting together your book, Apparitions at the Moment of Death. Oh, final question. I forgot. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
First of all, thank you for that. I
Yeah.
appreciate it. And they can find me on Twitter at near underscore death underscore FE. And I've posted a lot of cross-cultural kind of psychical accounts there. And then you can find my work on Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk, Barnes and all good bookstores, or the website of my publisher, which is innertraditions.com. And yeah, that's all. That's about all my presence on the web, the
Okay.
worldwide web.
And what was the Twitter X handle again?
I just realized I call it Twitter. I can't help it. It's funny.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's near underscore death underscore FE.
Effie, okay. All
Yeah.
right. Well, I will put links for the book and your Twitter handle, your X handle, in the show notes in the video description so that people can find you and follow you and
Thank
keep
you
on
so
track
much.
with what you're doing.
I
Well,
will.
thank
I
you
appreciate the
again.
interview.
Yeah, I appreciate your time as well. So thank you very
Thank you,
much.
and thanks for sharing that experience as well. It's fascinating.
And that's a wrap on episode 186 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, all my faithful listeners and viewers, my rebel spirits, know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends and family and on social media too, please. Subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill. But the thing is, all of this is really important. Sharing, subscribing, and liking, don't forget to like, are all free, and it only takes a second of your time, and it really does help. Subscriber numbers are important, as are likes on YouTube. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it, but a lot of work goes into creating each episode, several hours every week. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, and I know you know that, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. So I always like to say I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to spirituality, religion, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may it be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.